So we want to think a bit about what trauma is or means, and this means relating a bit to the past. So my definition of trauma is unpleasant symptoms in the present that are connected to past wounding. And that's an intentionally extremely broad definition, right? It encompasses having a certain kind of personality because I was raised in a certain place. It encompasses actual harm and abuse and attack and literal wounding. It encompasses attachment distress and the way that I carry the echo of or the results of my parents' parenting. It encompasses the larger arcs of oppression and social forces where I carry the karma or legacy of my race, gender, sexuality, groups that I find myself connected with, and I hold the various harms that have either been done, perpetrated by or upon those groups also in me. And part of this is all a way of saying that this is an embodied experience. Trauma is an embodied experience. We carry the echo of past wounds as a physical experience. So then we get to ask, what is the past actually? You know, this painful thing that happened to me or someone I love or my people in the past, what is that actually? And there's answers to this on many levels, right? On one level, it's just history. It is what happened. All of these levels have complications, right? We know from the study of history that the story of history, the narrative, is generally written by the victors in conflict. So how do we know exactly what was happening to the folks who lost the war? Or to the folks who didn't have the education to write their stories down? Or for most of certainly many cultures' history, women at all. So it turns out that a very small group of people tended to write most of the stories that we call history. So then, yes, things happened, but how do we know about them? And there's a whole realm of trauma that deals with not even knowing what happened. Or knowing what happened only through a certain person or a certain type of person's lens, viewpoint. From a practice perspective, meaning the path toward healing and cultivation of freedom, we want to ask questions like, what is the past to me now? Or what is the past to my community now? As a meditator, you know, we sit down to meditate, and there's all this stuff about presence, yeah? The power of now, yada yada. What does that mean? What does the now mean? There's no word for the now or presence in the Buddhist texts. It's not a concept. There's past, present, and future, but it's not emphasized as a, like, be in the now. That's not a thing. That arises later, it seems. And it might even be kind of a modernist leaning. Or we could say a historical kind of leaning. Once we have a concept that there is such a thing as the past, then we would have an idea that we live somewhere in relation to it. But that concept hasn't always been current. So we sit down to meditate, and the texts say something like, arouse mindfulness and bring your mindfulness to these things as they happen. Sensations, feelings, thoughts, states of being. And so trauma is a way of saying that the teaching on karma is true or useful. So without making this a talk on karma, here's the 3-minute version. The word karma means action. And in the Buddhist context, it means actions have results. And the way this plays out is that there's this recognition that we're encouraged to become fluent with, which is that what we are experiencing in any moment is the result of or is conditioned by everything that's happened before. And everything means everything, right? Like, I couldn't be sitting here with you had I not been, and it includes everything, right? Had I not had khichdi for lunch, or been raised Catholic, or been, you know, adopted at birth, or had a Jewish grandfather who converted, or, you know, growing up in a culture where educated light-skinned men get a lot of power. A million things that you could identify anything. Systemic things, family things, personal things, physical qualities, whatever lens you want to look through, you're going to see conditions. You're going to see karma. And all of that led to this. Some of it was positive, like I grew up middle class in a California suburb, and that meant I got a pretty safe childhood, free from a lot of danger, and I got a pretty solid education. Some of it was before Prop 13 killed the schools. So, lucky me. And some of it was negative, right? That adoption thing kind of played out as in the feeling of not really belonging anywhere. And that nice, safe suburb played out as a kind of depressive angst, which was accompanied by endless listenings to Depeche Mode, which helped, really, quite a bit. So what I call this is the privileged trauma spectrum. Basically, the past is composed of two kinds of things that happened to us. Some of them had relatively pleasurable or wholesome results, and those are different, but they're both useful in different ways to recognize. And some of them were painful and had unpleasant or harmful results, and again, those are different, and it's good to recognize the difference. The privileged trauma spectrum recognizes something really important about the past, which is that most of what happened to us, or around us, or through us, or with us, we do not own. And I only say most to be kind of gentle. The real Buddhist answer would be nothing. But, you know, just to be mellow for a bit here. It suggests that my current success is based on privilege, and my current wounding is based on trauma. And to the extent that I have some amount of each of those things in my system, my present experience is either tilting toward well-being or dis-ease in some way. So the Buddhists, once upon a time, asked questions like, well, how does this work? Like, what's up with this system? How does it unfold this way? They noticed that when harmful things are done, more pain and suffering seems to happen. And vice versa, pleasant things, more ease. And the Buddha practiced very pointedly toward this question of how do things happen? How do things unfold? And his realization that is formalized in the early texts begins with, these are the insights that the Buddha Gautama before he was the Buddha, had on the night he was awakened. And this is a myth now, right? So all of this is kind of deep metaphor. We don't know how historical it is. We know he existed historically, but like all the hero figures, his story is now primarily a metaphorical or mythic story. So after lots of practice, intense practice, various kinds of practice, he finds his way to an intuitive style of practice that no one had taught him, that uses aspects of what he was taught, but he intuits a new way. And when that practice comes to its fullness in a night of sitting, he first battles his demons. Doubt, grasping, lust, attachment, fear, hatred. The standard demons. Buddhism is beautiful in the story of the demons. It recognizes that the Buddha himself did not own or was unique in any of these demons. He had the same fixations as everybody. He thought he was being attacked by beings with weapons who wanted to kill him. And then he fantasized about being seduced by attractive people he liked. He resisted both of those, you could say, communal shadows. These are essentially built into cultures, most cultures. His and ours seem to be pretty similar in that way. I kind of fear the same things and lust after the same kinds of things. And then he had to have a conversation with doubt, and particularly self-doubt, the voice that says, you can't do this. And the only way through that was to call for help. And he called upon the earth goddess for help, as one should in such moments. And he called upon her wordlessly, which is the best way. And there's the images of the Buddha reaching down and touching the earth and asking for witness, asking to be seen. And what the Buddha asks for in this moment, it's called the earth witness moment, is to be seen in bearing in his body the result of eons of effort. In other words, he asked for his past to be seen, to be known. I think this is a profound moment when we're talking about trauma. Because he is not, we could even say, able to vanquish doubt on his own. He calls for help. He says, I need a witness. And the witness is here to say, the past was real. My effort was real. My sincerity is real. My struggles were real. I think when we are contending with a very painful past, particularly a very painful past, and now by a painful past, I'm going to mean both extremes on the trauma privilege spectrum. A painful past full of deep wounding and a past full of privilege so deep that we can't see it. We also need witness there because it's so diluted. Right? And the Buddha came from privilege. He was a rich kid. And it was only the sight of old age, sickness, and death that shook him out of his privilege. In other words, he went walking in the city. That's what shook him. So his story starts as a story of someone coming from profound privilege who sees other human beings suffering and is shaken out of the trance of privilege. And he goes searching. He asks for witness to his past. And the earth responds in some of the versions by making a massive earthquake that scatters the demons, the demon of doubt. In a different version, in a Thai version, and there's a beautiful sculpture of this in Bangkok at a big traffic roundabout, which is kind of funny. But in the Thai version of this moment, he calls upon the earth goddess and she, as a as a beautiful young woman walks up out of the river with her long hair drenched in water from bathing, and she wrings out her hair, and the flood from wringing out her hair washes away the armies of doubt. That's a nice little image. She wrings out her hair. So then Gotama settles into his meditation, having cleared his attention. And in the course of the night, he has three profound insights that are the substance of his liberation. And the first one particularly, and this is in a certain way why dealing with the past is the first thing we kind of have to do. And first might mean several more lifetimes, just saying. We have a long arc of patience in Buddhist land. The Buddha's first insight is to see his past lives. And he sees them in a particular way. First, he sees lots of them. The text says he saw his past lives, 1, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, countless past lives. So he kind of flashes on how long the past is and how repetitive it is, that people just keep getting born and dying, born and dying. And then it says he saw his past lives, his past births is the literal. He saw where he was born, what his name was, what he did for a living, what he ate, how he died, and the next. In other words, it's really basic in an interesting way, but part of what he sees is the particulars of each life. In this very, like, oh, I did this in this life, and I did this in this life. In this life, I was male. In this life, I was female. In this life, I was a dragon. In this life, I was a god. In this life, I was an ant. In this life, I was a poor person. In this person's life, I was a rich person. And the idea in the early text is that the energy that has turned out to be here has been lots of things in the past. And later on, that would turn into everything, right? Because in some infinities are big enough to contain other infinities, and I'll just leave it at that. That's a lecture that my physicist dad tried to tell me when I was like 12. He was like, think about it this way. If you added up all the numbers, all the integers, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to infinity, you'd get infinity, right? I'd be like, yeah. He's like, yeah, but what if you added up all the decimal points in between those numbers? You would also get infinity, right? I'd be like, yeah. And he was like, the second infinity is bigger than the first one. And I was like, because just try it on. You're just like, wait. And not if you're a math person. Like, okay, I know you get it. But the rest of us, where I'm just like, I get it if it's finite. But once they're both infinite, it's like mind blown gesture. So the Buddha does this. He's like, infinite lives, all this complexity, and he sees it initially in relation to the personal. This is the second sort of piece I want to emphasize for dealing with the past, is one layer or level or channel we have to deal with it through is the personal, the individual. My body, my family, the harm that was done to me or the harm that I individually did, this was real, this happened, and I can feel the results now in my body or in my heart, in the constrictions or the limitations or the haunting feeling that's always with me. The Buddha's second insight was the generalized version of that same one. And the text says, he saw how beings appear and pass on according to their actions. So not only that he saw his own past lives, but he saw that everyone is doing that same thing, has this long string of momentum behind them. And the second one is about action. This is the insight into karma. And the insight is that our actions are part of what conditions what happens next. And it's very, very important to to get that our actions are not the entirety of what conditions what happens next. Right? You can be a saint and still get run over by a bus. You can be a devil and, you know, become tremendously powerful. No names need to be mentioned here, because I don't call people devils. That's somebody else's job. But in a certain way, the insight speaks to something that should be, in a certain way, obvious. It's obvious if the thing we're looking at is not what materially happens, but our state in relation to it. So I cultivate some kindness, and then I go around the world being a kind person. And stuff is going to continue to happen to me, like good stuff and bad stuff, because that's just how it goes, having a body, being in cultures, being around other people. But the more kindness I cultivate, the more kindness and ease I'm going to feel. That's the karma of it. It's actually going to play out in subtle and beautiful ways. My friendships maybe are deeper. Right? I could still get run over by a bus. Why is it always a bus? I don't know. Right? Because you can sue the bus company. You can't, you know, I don't know. I remember when I was in San Francisco, at some point I was like, you know, it'd be terrible to be hit by something, but if I just got, like, clipped by a muni bus, I heard of a guy who got, like $100,000 from them. You know, I had some sort of fairly unethical fantasy to kind of bilk muni for some money. So, beings pass on according to their actions. And then the third of the insights was the insight of the uprooting of the causes of harmful action in oneself, in himself. So we find ourselves in something we could call the here and now, or the present. And what we find as we investigate, as we practice, is we find a body that is like a bell kind of ringing with past impacts. We can feel in ourselves the ache, the heartbreak of all the mistakes in relationship. We could feel in ourselves the sting of being a member of an oppressed group of people and how far back that goes. Or the sting of being an oppressor as we become awakened to our own role embedded in privilege. We find in the body, of course, the physical wounds and scars of harm done. And we particularly find it in the states of mind that we have access to. One of the core insights that the trauma work has to offer for the Buddhist and yoga world is that the experiences of poor practice, distraction, restlessness, dullness, inability to focus, these things that many traditional texts are just like, sit still, focus harder, like, you know. We start to recognize that those are qualities or patterns that are not random weather. It's not like, oh, it's suddenly hailstorming in Oakland for no reason. It's like, no. Weather is conditioned. Like, there was a change in pH in this water, which shifted the clouds in this place, which shifted the pressure in this place. And you can trace it outward if you can see big enough to see. All of our states, including everything that happens in meditation practice, in relational practice, is not random. You can't trace it like, oh, this is, I'm exactly distracted tonight because exactly, you know, my sweetheart said, you know, blah to your idea this morning. Like, it's not linear. It's more like, oh, dullness. I'm so familiar with dullness. What's up with that? And I rest into it. I'm like, oh, dullness. Who are you? What is this demon? I can barely see you clearly. And as I feel into it, I'm like, oh, I've felt this dullness for so long. And I'm like, what's up? And I'm just like, I'm just so tired. And if I'm like, why? And you don't want to think about the why. It's more like just the why is more like a is more like an opening to reality. And it's like, you know, oh, what I get is a kind of intuitive hit of a whole web of things, right? In my case, I get, you know, I get the adoption and feeling undercoupled from my family. I also get growing up in a California suburb in the 80s and how bad the music was, except for a few things. And I get like, oh, I get, you know, whatever channel I look in, I can trace aspects of that, right? I get like, oh, right, I grew up under Reagan and Thatcher. Of course I want to fall asleep, you know. Or like, whatever you look at, you find an aspect of it. You know, I grew up in the era of high fructose corn syrup. Like, wherever you look, you can trace privilege and trauma. And so our practice becomes not trying to untangle that web. That's the important part. You're not going to trace back to every single past thing that happened. It's impossible. Even if I'm like, oh, I was in this car accident, and then I went into shock, but then I didn't really get to complete the shock, so I'm carrying it in my body. That could be true. And we can unwind some of that, you know, in trauma therapy. But as a meditator, what I actually want to do is become intimate with this moment's experience. And this is a not easy shift for when we're deeply hypnotized by the intensity that we have experienced in the past. Because in a certain way, it means saying, that thing that happened to me, I'm going to set it down. I'm not going to churn through it, intentionally or unintentionally, if I can. What I'm going to do is I'm going to feel how I'm still shaking from it, or shut down, or whatever I am. And I want to stay with that. And some of the magic of trauma work in relation to the past, and some of the magic of mindfulness work in relation to trauma, is that we insist in a certain way on staying present. So I connect with heart, mind, body as it's happening right now, and what I get is the ringing. And let's go with the bell metaphor. I'm a bell. I'm like, whoa, I'm still vibrating. And I kind of get the intuition, I get the hit, that the strike that I'm ringing from was a long time ago. Or actually, it was a lot of strikes over time. The first thing I want to sense is, am I being hit in this moment? Right? And if that's true, you get out. It's mostly not true, God willing, for y'all, for most, hopefully. Therefore, I have a moment in practice. All of that equivocating was a way of saying, if you're meditating, it's not happening right now. And if it is happening right now, meditation is not your path. Right? Restraining order, or whatever it is the path. So if you're meditating, if you're on the mat or the cushion, then it's not happening right now. You're in a safe room, a safe space. Therefore, what we can do is we can, noticing that, turn toward the ringing body. And be like, oh, it's just ringing. I connect with the past through the present. Not through memory or story, but through the body, if I can, when I can. And then I feel the ringing. And as I feel the ringing, and I don't think about the strike, the ringing dies down a little more. And the one of the painful things about distraction or anxiety particularly, is that every little thought about what happened or what might happen in the future is another little strike. It's like saying, oh, I remember being hit, and it was like this. It was like this. It was like this. It was like this. It's going to be like this in the future. It's going to be like this in the future. And I'm like, how's the bell ever going to stop ringing if you keep hitting it? The ringing itself is not a problem. It's the nature of bells to ring. It's the nature of a body to vibrate with the past. But when the ringing is strong, as it is for most of us, when trauma, when the blend of trauma and privilege, or past harm and support have mixed up in us to make a really deluded sense of ourselves, our practice is, in a certain way, stop flicking the bell. Just ring. Set up the conditions so that you can ring longer without flicking it. That means mostly not being alone for many folks. Lots of the little instructions we give are about this. Don't close your eyes if that is a tendency to wander off and keep hitting the bell. Be together rather than alone. Move rather than being in stillness, if stillness is more triggering. There's points in practice, like the ringing dies down quite a bit, and you're like, okay, I want to really deal with this, because the ringing has died down, but I'm actually afraid of it ringing again. Then I'm like, oh, we need to actually re-trigger it in order to die down more. And so I'll be like, tell me a little bit about what happened. Tell a little bit. As soon as you start telling it, the ringing goes up again. Great. Pause. Feel it. And we're going to work like this in a way. We do this in meditation. You're sitting, and suddenly you're just thinking about something, that thing that happened. On long retreat, this will happen, sometimes many weeks in. Mind gets really quiet, really spacious. It's just open and sweet and easeful. And then I sit down one day, and it's just like, you know, there was a few varieties for me. My most standard variety was all the mistakes I've ever made in relationship. Right? It takes about a sitting. And it would just be like, okay, you know, Tina in eighth grade. Sorry. You know, Jim when I was 11. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, you start like wherever it starts, it zigzags or it goes in linear order. I'm a little bit organized inside, so often it would go in linear order. And it would just be like this person, that person, this person, that person. The first 20 times this happened, I was like, oh, distraction, distraction, trying to come back. Time number 21 or 121, or I don't even know, I was like, oh, something's unfinished. You know, face palm. Took me a long time to figure that out. I was like, oh. Next time it happened, I was like, oh, Jim, when I was 11, I'm so sorry. I hope you're well. Tina, eighth grade, I'm so sorry. I hope you're well. And it's a whole different process then. And this really opens into what is the next step in dealing with the past, which is forgiveness practice. Not always available in the beginning. I think the first practice is just witness. This was true. Then it's, this was true and I can feel it now. Then it's, this is no longer happening, but I care about my own and others' actions. And from there, the beautiful forgiveness practice that we've done a couple times in this group. The intention, whatever the other did that was harmful to me or those I love and care about, intentional or unintentional, I have the intention to forgive that. Whatever I did to another or those they care about, intentional or unintentional, I ask for forgiveness. And whatever I did to myself, intentional or unintentional, I ask for forgiveness. I offer myself forgiveness. All of this is a way of saying, how do we allow the past to resolve, to come to rest? And this is maybe a definition of enlightenment in the Buddhist system. The Buddha goes seeking for the deathless. And the phrase that in the early texts is used when someone comes to the end of causing suffering is, done is what had to be done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is a way of saying, the past is entirely resolved, and no more past will be created. And that's really a mystery, because that doesn't mean dead. The Buddha realized that at 35 and then taught for 45 years, walking around, getting involved in politics, making mistakes, teaching. But when he was asked, where are you now, after having realized that, he would say, it's not the right question. Mostly he would leave it at that. So I will too. So, your thoughts and feelings welcome, your responses, and really anything about your practice. Yeah, Andy.
It's you didn't talk about this, but it's related to nervous system stuff.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if, like, when there is, like, residual muscle tension, or, like, there's muscle tension in the body that's carried around for a long time,
yeah,
if this is, like, can be thought of as trauma, or it's related. I especially noticed that, like, when those things are released, there's, like, a lot of, like, sometimes there's a lot of shaking and stuff like,
yeah,
that, which is also like a sign of
as the great Ida Rolf said, the issues are in the tissues. So yeah, I think of really any habitual state as connected to the as conditioned by the past. And so then a habitual painful state, as you could call it trauma, you know. I mean, maybe we all carry a particular trauma in our shoulders. You know, and it's called, what, industrial capitalism? It's called, you know, it's called the death of God. Like, whatever you come from, it doesn't have to be like, they hit me and therefore I always hold my shoulder up. It can be subtler than that, you know. It could be just that, like, yeah, you know, life since the invention of agriculture has been kind of stressful. You know.
And then do, like, the mechanisms for resolving these things work the same way, like psychological and bodily trauma?
They seem to. I don't want to be overly simplistic, but it seems like, you know, contacting a part of the body that is, you know, we could say ringing with some habit. One of the ways that we'll do it, like in the kind of work that I do, is just to make contact in a way that's extremely stable and not adding further energy to the thing, but almost like, you know, if someone's really freaking out, one of the things you can do is just kind of be near them and get really calm. And you almost kind of pull them into your state, right? Or you suggest to them, you give them something to bounce off of. And a limb will, I'll hang out with a limb, and it'll kind of just, like, do its thing. It's like, and every once in a while, somebody was on the table a couple weeks ago, and I was holding their shoulder, and they were like, their leg was twitching, they were doing all this crazy stuff, and I was like, how you doing in there? And they were just like, I don't know what you're doing, but this is a fucking trip. And I'm like, cool, carry on, you know. Like, I'm not doing much, but what I'm doing is I'm, you know, giving something for it to bounce off of. And it seems to do that and come to often, not always, but sometimes, you know, if the intervention is attuned to some kind of further coherence. And that can be similar, you know, with like psycho-emotional stuff. You come into contact with something that's coherent or stable, and the non-coherence or instability is seen more clearly, right? And then is allowed somehow to deactivate. Yeah, Caitlin.
So you mentioned, and I know that we've done this together, where you kind of, in order to get the to work through the ringing and have the ringing start to dim gradually, you bring it up so it can be felt, and then back away. That's one of the ways of experiencing and healing. So what if? What if the ringing comes up in a situation where, not that you can't back away, but you might not want to back away like performing, mm-hmm. or like, you know, like music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know that I experience all three of the nervous system activation states.
Totally.
During different aspects of performing.
Yeah.
Me
too.
Yeah, and my intuition is like, okay, well, you know, allow, you know, it's not so bad that I, like, go into complete shock. I'm able to, like, stay there and go through. But my intuition is like, okay, well, you know, put yourself in that situation enough time so your body understands that you're not actually in danger.
Maybe. But, I mean, they say Michael Jackson just, like fell apart every single time he went off stage.
Well, that's the question I have, is, like, is that traumatizing you further?
It could be, but it doesn't have to be, I think. The instructions are more or less the same, except that in a certain way your intention is not to, is not, resolving the ringing isn't your foreground intention while you're performing, perhaps. Right, your intention is to do your performance, which can be a really good thing, because one of the things you can do is just concentrate on what you're doing, like ignore it and concentrate, and what you'll do is not further inflame it, right? Because again, it's repetitive worry that keeps flicking the bell. Mm-hmm. So if you just concentrate on singing or playing or doing whatever, and you give it kind of no attention, it doesn't have that much fuel to go with. You have to have some concentration to do that, but you have. The other main tool I would say is orientation, right? Like, all of these states are fueled particularly by getting lost in internal content. You know, oh no, do I sound bad? I'm sounding bad. You know, da-da-da-da. Rather than just being like, you know, I see the lights, I see faces, I see the music, or I hear the music, I feel my body here in the crook of the piano, or with the weight of the guitar, or wherever you are, you orient to the present. You know, and again, you pull your attention away from the ghost. And in a sense, all of this, we could say, is you starve the ghost through inattention. And then, if you want to go further into it, you come into a session where you're not performing, and you're like, hey, I freak out every time I perform. And we'll be like, cool, imagine yourself performing. And you're like, ah! And like, great, what does it feel like? You're like, oh, I'm just ringing. And then we could be like, cool, hang out with that. And give it attention now. Right? So, you know, different things to do if you're committed to that the show must go on.
Yeah. You know,
it's useful to be like you don't need to fall apart on stage or stuff it or contain or somehow be a broken performer. That also doesn't serve.
Well, I noticed it has a, like, just, you know, at a certain point, you just can't, if you're activated to a certain point, you can't physically do what you can do when you're not activated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's very physical, a physical handicap.
Absolutely.
And so that's my motivation. Well, and also it's really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, yeah. This is, why is this so activating? Because it's like, yeah. Oh, I'm singing a song about being in love. Or, you know, I mean, I guess that's...
It could be activating, but no, you can, I think your curiosity is, you know, kind of the best tool here.
Yeah.
You know, put yourself in a hall where you might perform, you know, at 9 a.m. with nobody in there, and just stand on the stage and feel it, you know, or whatever you do. Invent some scenario where you can get into contact with that feeling in a safe setting. And see what you can know about it.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Is breaking through part of why I like it? Like breaking through all that? Because is there a point in your performance where you're like, now I'm enjoying it? Because that's that part, the ringing is gone?
There have been like specific performances where I've experienced that, but I mean, it's a good question. I feel like that's something I'd have to like keep in mind to come back. It's not like it's there and then it just goes away. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like it's really intense and I'm like, whoa, my arms are buzzing, and you know, and then there'll be moments where I'm not as aware of it because I'm more focused on what I'm doing. And then there'll be, you know, moments where I feel really free, and then there'll be another moment where it's like it's a constantly change. The levels change throughout, you know, the moment of the experience. So
I like this question, though, because it points to the pleasure in performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not just the, like, oh, no.
Yeah. And maybe you need that to get there, you know? Like, maybe it's actually a medicine for you.
Well, I think it is.
Yeah.
But the pleasure, that's a really good thing. I'm going to keep that in mind. Just like, at what point does that, you know, like, what's the relationship between what draws me to do this thing that causes me to be activated, and where is the pleasure in that? What's the relationship between the activation and the pleasure?
Yeah, because I think that your intuition is probably on, that there is a relationship, right? So then,
I know it well.
You know it. Right? yeah. Totally. Yeah, Peter.
I'm interested in how we today not create a new trauma. So something can break up, or somebody who gets mugged, maybe myself or somebody I love, or some scary thing happens.
Yeah.
What's the instruction or to process it now?
Yeah.
So it doesn't become a trauma that 10 years from now gets triggered.
Yeah. So, it's a great question. What do we do now or in the moment, immediately after, essentially? Difficult things happen so that they don't linger in that way. I think it's mostly about completing or resolving the impact. So for instance, you know, I get in a car accident, I'm a little bit in shock, you know, I kind of freak out a little bit, but then I just kind of go back to work. Because, you know, who has time, really? To heal anything nowadays. So, you know, I could instead be like, oh, I got in this car accident. You know, I'm going to make a little bit of time, and I'm going to, like, you know, be with someone I trust, and I'm going to go home, and I'm going to, you know, and I'm going to lie down on the floor, and I'm just going to slowly contact my body again. And kind of, and as I sink into it, I'm going to feel the fear of it, and I might, and if I can, if it's hard to contact it, I might actually walk myself through it, or with somebody, tell the story of it 20 times. You know, with a person being really curious, like, oh, when was the first moment you knew it was shifting? Like, oh, when was the moment when you knew it was over? All this is basic kind of tracking through a difficult experience thing. But telling it and then feeling it in the body is a way of saying to your body, like, oh, you know, it's okay, it's over. And feeling through all the layers, as many layers as we can, of the feelings that are there. I think about, like, what is resolution? Like, what does it mean for something to be done, for the past to be sealed? Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this a bit in the past. There's something like, it's not haunting me anymore. I know it's true, mm-hmm. but it's not haunting. And that's a delicate one because you can't rush to that. Right, there's all these layers in healing where I have to actually hold on to it for a while, maybe a long time, maybe lifetimes. You know, there's cultural traumas where it's really important to never forget. And then there's layers of that can be like, I won't ever forget, but I don't need to carry it in my body. And that's personal, or that's family, or that's cultural, and no one can say, especially to another group or an oppressed group or a harmed person, that they should do that or that it's time to do that. I think that's a result that comes, you know, in its time. But that there is this experience of like, that happened, that's true, that was painful, I've seen it, I've worked with it, and, you know, here I am now with the capacity to be happy and at ease. And so the work, whatever we can do in the immediate aftermath to be safe and then recontact well-being and peel away the layers of shock and activation, which can totally be done, helps a ton. You know. When my toddler falls down or does something, often what we'll do is we'll hang out there and he'll cry for a little bit, and then we'll have this whole interaction where I'm like, oh yeah, you tripped on that crack. Your foot hit that thing, and he'll look at it and he'll go, like, yeah, you hit that. And then you fell on the ground, and he's like, and I'm like, yeah, you bumped your head on the ground. And I'll get really slow, and he'll get upset, or he'll kind of fog out. And I'll be like, yeah, you tripped. And then you went, boom. And he'll go, and I'm like, yeah. And then he's like, snack? And I know that we've done our little piece of work, right? But I'm going to do that instead of just like scooping him up and being like, it's okay, right? Because that's not going to give his system any chance to settle or to even know what happened. And the main thing is like, here's the story. This is what happened. You felt it here, it hurt. How's it doing now? Snack? Cool. We're done. Yeah, last round.
So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the instructions around the ringing bell, because I'm hearing different things, and I'm wondering what really is the instruction. I find often, most times when I sit down to meditate, I have to contend with stories and wounds and worries about the future and things about the past, and then usually what ends up happening for me is just like kindness and compassion and gentleness.
Yeah.
Which kind of quiets down so I can be present in the moment.
Yeah.
And I think I have done like work around healing some, so I know what you're talking about a little bit about like accepting what is.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear you saying things like back off it or like bring it up, like conjure it, and then
Right. What's the toolbox?
Right.
And it is a toolbox, it's not one thing.
What are you doing to get the bell to come down?
In a certain way, most of the instructions I give are different tools for how you might work with that. But here's one that feels kind of central. And it's working with whether my attention is inward or outward, internal or external. internal is going to tend to be more activating, and external is going to tend to be less activating in most situations, but not for everybody. That's the tagline that goes with everything. But like anxious thoughts, worry about the future, one of the things I can do is I can say, okay, but where am I now? And I open the eyes, I look at something, I focus outward, I listen to some sounds, and it pulls my attention away from that particular little vortex. I connect with something pleasurable. I'm like, okay, I'm really worried, but there's all these nice people here, and I kind of like them, despite myself. Gosh, you know. And I turn my attention toward that. So again, that's external. Sometimes I'm like, no, I want to contact this feeling and find some resolution in the feeling, and I'm not so lost that I'm unable to do that. Then I could be like, bring attention internal. Feel the body ringing, but don't tell the story 100 times. And then it's like, oh, there's just this ache in my chest or a rock in the belly or my arms are vibrating. And if you can, stay with that as sensation. If you can't, like you contact it and the activation increases and the story increases, then it's too strong to go internal with. And you would again come external. You'd be like, okay, whew, all right, wow, right on, cool. You know, hello me. And it's fine. And you play with it. And all the things you're talking about, like you bring kindness to it, these are all ways essentially to say, don't get lost in the, don't get hooked by the content, but finding the pathway to whatever gets the ringing to cool down. And bringing attention in or out is one of the main kind of, you know, levers on the mixing board you can work with, right? And in a sense, all of our instructions are levers to work with, right? They're like, do you focus way in to a point, or do you get really broad and spacious? You know, do you focus on your own individual being, or do you connect with your communal belonging? Like, all of them, I call them spectra, essentially, spectrums, are ways of saying, where's the pathway to the bell completing, to the sound completing, essentially. And I just play with, you know, any of those that I have access to find the way. For sure. All right, friends. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming to chat about this. I'm not sure what we'll talk about next week.
We already said 4th of July.
Oh. July 4th.
I think it's closed.
The studio's probably closed. Good on you, people who remember federal holidays and stuff. Thank you. All right. So no, almost certainly no satsang next Tuesday. That's fine. I will see you the week after. And we'll go on. I think that means that I won't see you next week. I will see you the week after. And the week after that, I'll be doing a retreat training for the organic intelligence trauma work. So there will be a sub here, and then I will resume the week after. And that week after is the 18th, and that is the week that the philosophy course starts on the 20th. So get on that if you want to come and look deeply into that stuff with me. I'd love to have you. Blessings for your week, blessings for your 4th of July. May something be liberated or independent or decolonized or freed. Yeah, I don't know. Have a barbecue, listen to Katy Perry. Something. May all beings be free of the yoke of oppression. And your generosity in supporting this group is deeply and warmly gratefully received. Thank you for your generosity. The more privilege you have had to have some resources allows you to practice with that privilege to support those who haven't had that. So as generous as you can be, really helps others to be here. Donations go in the basket over there. And see you soon. Thank you.